This year, we're privileged to host the Reverend Dr. George Athos. George has been married to Kula for 18 years. They have two lovely daughters, Hosanna and Josephine, and as a family, they attend Earlwood Anglican Church. George's parents were both born in Greece, but migrated to Sydney in the 60s. Here, they both became evangelical Christians, and so George, born in Sydney, was raised in a Christian home. George is an ancient linguist, an epigrapher, and an historian. George received his PhD from the University of Sydney before studying theology at Moore College and being ordained in the Anglican Church. George has lectured Old Testament at Moore College for the last 9 years and is currently the college's Dean of Research. George has just completed a large collaborative work producing a reader of the Hebrew Bible for students of Biblical Hebrew, which will be released later this year. He's currently writing a commentary on the book of Deuteronomy and is associate editor of Zondervan's New Story of God Bible Commentary Series. Would you please welcome George to deliver the 2014 Warrawee Lecture, The Buried King.
Well, good evening, everyone. It's nice to be with you, and thank you to Bruce for the invitation to deliver this year's Warrawee Lecture. If you go to Jerusalem today, you can find your way to a building just south of the old city, known as the Cenacle, or if you prefer the more ancient term, the Coenaculum. And there you can visit the tomb of David. Here, it is supposed, you can stand before the sarcophagus that holds the body of ancient Israel's great dynastic founder, David, the son of Jesse. But all is not as it seems. The original structure of the building in which this sarcophagus is located dates back only to the 4th century AD, and David is said to have lived sometime during the 11th and 10th centuries BC. Also, the hill on which this building is located is generally known as Mount Zion these days, but this is not, in fact, the real, actual Mount Zion. This came about through a late misidentification of the geography of Jerusalem. The original Mount Zion is in fact 400 metres to the east of this particular one on a finger of hill known as the Ophel, or the City of David. And yet, for those who would believe it, like many a medieval venerated saint, this is where King David is buried. Now, this situation serves as a bit of a poignant picture of the historicity of King David himself, because up until recently, it appeared that scholarship was ready to bury King David forever, concluding that David was not a fabulous king like the Bible claimed he was, because he didn't even exist. And yet, when we do some digging, we start to see things in a new light. And so David, it seems, has experienced something of an historical resurrection and is being rehabilitated to the pages of history. Tonight, I want to take us on a bit of a journey and look at how history was ready to bury David for good, how David made an unexpected comeback, and then reflect a little bit on how the Bible and history intersect and what exactly we should be meaning when we affirm that the Bible is historical. About a century ago, archaeology was still in its infancy as a scientific endeavour, and throughout the first half of the 20th century, pretty much, it was largely seen as the handmaiden of biblical studies. The archaeologist was someone who went to various sites throughout the countries that we today know as Israel, Jordan, and the territories of Palestine. And the archaeologist had a spade in one hand and a Bible in the other. The American archaeologist William Foxwell Albright is perhaps the most famous proponent of that particular approach, though I suspect he himself probably wouldn't put it that way. That's certainly how he's been characterised since. But from about the mid-20th century or so, particularly with excavations conducted by Dame Kathleen Kenyon throughout Palestine, archaeology began to move out from underneath the shadow of biblical studies, and it started to become a discipline in its own right. And the trend towards leaving the Bible behind and taking only the spade along to excavations had begun. And these days that is well and truly the case, most of the time. The trend of leaving the Bible behind during excavations gained a lot of momentum in the mid-1970s when two scholars published two major works that questioned the historicity of Abraham and the patriarchs of Israel. These two scholars were Thomas Thompson, who in 1974 wrote The Historicity of the Patriarchal Narratives, The Quest for the Historical Abraham. And the following year, John Van Saters wrote Abraham in History and Tradition. These two books started a chain reaction that brought almost all of Old Testament history into question. And these books had such an impact that today the view of these two books is taken by many scholars as axiomatic. Now, from that time, from the mid-70s, the historicity of the Bible has steadily been eroded. Thompson and Van Saters, for example, questioned, at the beginning of this process, they questioned the historicity of Abraham by trying to demonstrate from clues in the patriarchal narratives of Genesis, which had been used to put Abraham initially in the early second millennium BC, roughly 1800 BC, and stating that they could just as easily be used to put Abraham in the post-exilic era, in about 400 BC. In other words, they argued that there was nothing especially early about the portrayal of Abraham. Not long after that, the same kind of argumentation was used to question the Exodus from Egypt. After all, scholars had known for a very long time that there was practically no evidence outside the biblical text for the Exodus from Egypt. And so the Exodus was consigned largely to history's scrap heap. Then the long-standing debate about the nature and historicity of the conquest under Joshua began, and this was decided as many scholars abandoned any notion of an actual military conquest of Canaan by the Israelites. Not long after that, the period of the Judges was questioned as mere folk tales. And you can see where this is heading. The next target was the United Monarchy under David and Solomon. And this is where the debate really got heated, because when we get to the United Monarchy, we are starting to deal with political entities in the land that we today know as Israel and Palestine. Then, in 1993, this was found, the Tel Dan inscription, or rather some of it was found. On a July evening, early evening, as Gila Cook, one of the excavation team that was digging at Tel Dan in the far north of Israel, just literally a stone's throw from the border with Lebanon, she was sketching the state of play after the day's excavations. And as she was looking at particular stones, a particular wall, she noticed that the sun was flecking off a particular stone that caught her attention. She went up to this stone, scrubbed away some of the dust, and lo and behold was the fragment that you see there on the right, what we know as fragment A. Now, what was interesting about this, and I'm not sure if you're able to see it on the screen, but there is a particular word here on this inscription. It's written in Aramaic, ancient Aramaic. There is a particular word that is chalked there in white, just to highlight it. And that word is the Aramaic phrase, Beit David, House of David. And that caused a huge stir, just as history was getting ready to bury David. Here we have a reference to the House of David. That was 1993. The following year, and a further two fragments were found. They were the fragments there on the left that you see. The top one is known as B1, and the one below is fragment B2. I like to know them as the bananas in pyjamas fragments. Here is the site of Tel Dan. This is the Israelite city gate. As it looked a number of years ago now, if you go there, it has largely been, much of it's been reconstructed, a little better than what it appears in this photo. And this is where fragment A was found. It was actually found recycled as a brick in a wall. Fragment B1 was found over here in some debris, in some what appeared to be destruction debris. And B2 not far away, also in some debris. Now, you hear the word the phrase House of David, and immediately that evokes the biblical David. This particular find, the Tel Dan inscription, really polarized scholarship. On the one hand, there was that quarter of scholarship that argued this had nothing to do with the biblical David, because David was not a real person. There had been no other finds archaeologically that could prove David's existence, let alone the existence of an early Israelite state or kingdom or empire. So, of course, David was entirely a fictional character. How could this possibly refer to David? And yet on the other side of the ring were those scholars who immediately jumped up and down and fist-pumped the air and said, "See, we told you so. Here he is. We've found David." Now, the consensus today about this particular inscription, the Tel Dan inscription, is that the fragments are to be seen, as you see there in that particular photo. You've got fragment A on the right and fragments B1 and B2 on the left. And that's how they are to be matched up. And if you read the lines across and fill in some of the gaps with some educated guesses, we can figure out what this particular inscription means and what it says. And it's argued, most scholars today hold, that the author of this inscription was Hazael, the king of Damascus, another figure who is known from the Bible. And in this inscription, Hazael, the king of Damascus, is taking credit for the coup of Jehu, son of Nimshi, who is also known in the Bible. He is an Israelite who overthrew the dynasty of Omri and his son Ahab. And in this particular inscription, so the consensus theory goes, Hazael takes credit for the killing of Jehoram, king of Israel, and Ahaziah, the king of Judah, Judah here being referred to by its dynastic title, the House of David. Now, I had the privilege of working on this particular inscription and trying to understand it and its context. While I was doing so, one particular scholar out of Copenhagen, Professor Fred Cryer, argued that this particular inscription was a hoax. It was a fake. He came out with the allegation claiming that he had photographic evidence that this particular inscription was, in fact, a hoax. He kept his cards fairly close to his chest, not telling anyone what the evidence was until he revealed that the evidence, the photographic evidence, was in a photo that he himself had taken at the Israel Museum in Jerusalem, where the inscription was housed. But he took it illegally without permission, and therefore he couldn't publish it. Now, while I was working on this, I was working on this inscription for my PhD thesis. If this particular inscription turned out to be a fake, I had to find a new topic for my PhD. Fred Cryer eventually let people know what he thought the evidence was, and he let me know that he thought that there were chisel marks on some of the exposed surfaces. That is, chisel marks on the surfaces which should have been inside the stone when it was carved. Chisel marks don't naturally appear inside stone. They appear on external surfaces, but certainly not on internal surfaces. And yet he claimed on the back of this particular fragment, fragment A, on the right there, there was in fact a chisel mark. Off I went to Jerusalem to inspect, and I found out that what Fred Cryer thought was a chisel mark was in fact not a chisel mark. We can tell exactly what a chisel mark on stone looks like. It has particular characteristics, and this particular scratch that he saw was certainly not a chisel mark. It was, in fact, a naturally inflicted scratch, presumably sustained when the original stele, that is, the original whole inscription, was destroyed. And so based on personal examination, I had a look at the inscription and determined that the consensus was almost impossible. In the photo there, as you see it, this is how the inscription is currently displayed at the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. Unfortunately, there are particular characteristics of the inscription here that are now hidden by the way the inscription is displayed. There are certain parts that have been plastered over. For example, particularly where the two sides of the inscription join. They don't, in fact, join quite so easily. There is a very deceptive diagonal line of breakage which seems like it's all the same line. You can follow it from the top left all the way down to the top to the bottom right. And that looks like one single line of breakage. Unfortunately, that's actually just circumstantial evidence, because if we look underneath, which is now unfortunately in plaster, when I examined it, it hadn't been put in plaster yet. It's very clear that the fragments don't actually belong side by side like this. Furthermore, I examined the various slants on each of the fragments, and it's quite clear that the slant of the writing on fragment A does not match the slant of the writing on the B fragments on the left. There is every indication, rather, that fragment A belongs to an upper portion of the original stele, and fragments B1 and B2 belong to lower portions of the original stele. To my surprise, I also found an extra letter, which doesn't really appear here on the photographs. There is on fragment A, let me see if I can get a cursor going here. Just here, there is a little bit of a, what we call a lacuna. There is a bit of a breakage in the stone. And there is a, what looks to be a kind of a scratch just above it. And I had a look at that particular scratch, which everyone else seems to have missed. And to my surprise, this scratch had all the characteristics of a chisel mark, of a deliberately carved letter, just like every other stroke written on the surface of this particular inscription. I was so stunned by this, I looked at this one scratch for an hour, examining to make sure that I wasn't seeing things, but no, I wasn't. This was, in fact, a chisel mark. There was an extra letter here, and after playing around with certain images, I found out that actually we could fit an extra letter in this particular space. It doesn't look like much of a space because of the actual lacuna in the stone there, but that extra letter completely changes the meaning of the inscription. The consensus reading becomes impossible. The other thing that I noted was that the consensus reading of this particular inscription was made before the entire area at the gate of Tel Dan had been fully excavated. In other words, we jumped the gun. We didn't know everything there was to know about the context in which these fragments were found. Once we did know the context, and scholarship unfortunately continues to ignore this context, they don't read the excavation reports from a few years later, it's evident that the inscription comes from a slightly later time, than was originally thought and is originally espoused in the consensus reading. And so I determined that the author of this particular inscription was not in fact Hazael, the king of Damascus. It was in fact his son, Bar-Hadad. Bar-Hadad is known to us in the Bible as Ben-Hadad. And the inscription was broken, most likely, by the Israelite king Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, who defeated the Arameans, that is, the people of Damascus and its surrounds, defeated them three times. You may remember the narrative of the prophet Elisha on his deathbed, calling King Jehoash to strike the ground with his bow and arrow. And he struck the ground three times, and Elisha took him to task, saying, "You should have struck five or six times. Now you will defeat Damascus only three times." That's the king we are talking about. King Jehoash is the one who defeated Damascus in three battles, and certainly this particular inscription seems to have come after one particular victory. The inscription itself is King Jehoash boasting of his fabulous success, particularly in the military arena, and trying to dissuade people from rebelling against his sovereignty in the face of ever-encroaching Israelite sovereignty. It was too little too late. This inscription was probably only standing for perhaps a year or two in roughly 798 BC or thereabouts before King Jehoash of Israel defeated Bar-Hadad and his armies, retook the city of Dan, that is the modern site of Tel Dan, and in so doing, destroyed any signs of Bar-Hadad's sovereignty over Tel Dan, including destroying this particular inscription and recycling a nice good chunk of it as a brick in a wall. The fact that this inscription is so well preserved attests to the fact that it hadn't been standing very long and was recycled in such a place in the wall where it wasn't going to be eroded all that much. I then turned my attention to the phrase, House of David. What is the House of David? One of the things we know is that it's very unusual in the ancient Near East to describe a kingdom by... it's common to describe a kingdom by its dynastic founder. The Assyrians, for example, knew the kingdom of Israel as the House of Omri, after one of the dynastic founders of Israel, Omri, who was the one who founded the city of Samaria. It makes sense then, according to the consensus reading, to identify the kingdom of Judah as the House of David. The problem with that is, this particular phrase, House of David, here, seems to be, in a phrase, the king of the House of David. Nowhere in the ancient Near East is anyone referred to as the king of a dynasty. It is a very unusual thing to say. It is almost like saying, not the Queen of England, but the Queen of Buckingham Palace. It's just very unusual. However, it is very common to describe cities with the word house. There are numerous places in the Bible, for example, which have the word Beth in front of them. Bethlehem, Beth Shemesh, and many, many others. The word Beth there is Hebrew for house. And I surmised that if that was the case, what we have here is not actually a dynastic title, House of David, but rather a geographical term, House of David. In other words, what I think we have here is the Aramaic equivalent of City of David. This is referring to the king of the city of David, that is Jerusalem. Now, the Tel Dan inscription doesn't prove the historicity of David. It's not actually about David. It's simply referring to, amongst other things, a king of the House of David. It can only be indirect evidence of David. it is not direct evidence of David. At best, it is like a vague footprint of David. It's certainly not David himself. So the Tel Dan inscription does not prove the historicity of David or the biblical narratives about him. But it does give us some dots in history that we can begin to join. Jerusalem, being called House of David or City of David, does not prove David existed any more than Rome, being called Rome, proves that Romulus existed, or Athens, being called Athens, proves that Athena existed. But whereas Rome and Athens have always been known by those names, Jerusalem is a slightly different case. We know Jerusalem from the archaeological record as Urusalim from before this time. It's referred to as Urusalim, for example, in the Amarna letters from Egypt, which are correspondence between local chiefs or local kings in Canaan and the Egyptian pharaoh Akhenaten in Egypt. And they date to the mid-14th century BC, a good 300 to 400 years before David himself. And we also know Jerusalem as Urushalimu from Assyrian records after David's time, and certainly after the time of the Tel Dan inscription, which is roughly 800 BC. So from before the time of the Tel Dan inscription, we know Jerusalem was known as Urushalim, and afterwards it was known as Urushalimu, and yet at one particular time in the middle there, it's referred to as House or City of David. Not long after the Bible says that David captured Jerusalem and renamed it City of David. You've got to ask yourself, why, for a short period of time, was Jerusalem not referred to as Jerusalem, but City of David? There is a very good narrative story in the Bible that provides a fairly credible reason for the change of name. It is very common for dynastic founders to start new capital cities and to rename them after themselves. One particular example of this is the Assyrian king Sargon, who founded Dur-Sharrukin, Fort Sargon, as his new capital. Now, part of the debate that led scholars to be ready to bury David was the evidence from Jerusalem itself. Here's an artist's recreation of what Jerusalem might have looked like in the time of David, or rather the time of Solomon. Even that, however, I think is a rather generous picture. See, the question is, was Jerusalem a legitimate urban centre that David could conquer and from which David could rule an entire kingdom and perhaps even forge an entire empire? At one stage, scholars were characterising Jerusalem, according to the scarce archaeological evidence, as a cow town during the time that David was supposed to have reigned. Could someone legitimately rule a kingdom or an empire from what seemed to be little more than a backwater or a small village? And we have to admit, there are sparse archaeological remains from what we know as Iron Age II Jerusalem, the time of King David and King Solomon. But this is where literary evidence becomes quite crucial. I mentioned the Amarna letters just a moment ago from the mid-14th century BC, in which local chiefs or kings in Canaan were corresponding with the Egyptian pharaoh Akhenaten. One of those particular kings was Abdichepa of Urushalim, the king of Jerusalem. We have his letters found at Amarna in Egypt. We have references to him from other Amarna letters also. And yet when we look at the archaeological record of the time in which Abdichepa himself lived, Jerusalem doesn't seem to be a bustling urban centre. It's there, but there doesn't seem to be all that much that is there. And so there is scope for understanding Jerusalem, even as a small town, still being a place from which a king could rule. If we then look at the biblical texts, we're called to read them rather closely to see what exactly they say and don't say about Jerusalem. And in fact, if we do read the narratives, particularly 2 Samuel 5, we'll see that David did in fact capture not an entire city, but a fortress. A fortress that had up until that time been known as Zion. And he renamed this fortress City of David. The narrative then tells us that he started to build some houses around it. In other words, the picture is of a rather sparsely settled place rather than a bustling city. The city certainly had some older walls, and archaeologists have been able to dig up evidence of these older walls. And the narrative of Kings goes on to tell us that Solomon then built significantly more. But it seems that what David captured was, in fact, a small town. The word city is something that we tend to associate a large metropolis with. But in ancient times, a city was whatever an ancient person defined as a city, and that could even simply be a fortification, a fortress. And that certainly seems to have been the case with ancient Jerusalem. Now, Jerusalem itself is a bit of a problem for us, for archaeologists particularly, because we just simply cannot dig where we would like. Unfortunately, we cannot go in, knock on people's doors and say, "We would like to dig in your kitchen, please, for the next 20 years. Would you allow us to do it?" And we certainly can't go encroaching on the holy sites of the Haram Sharif or the Temple Mount. Those particular areas are off limits. As much as we would love to dig, we can't. We have to find the spaces between the buildings, the car parks, the laneways to dig, and that's where most archaeological endeavour is focused these days. The other thing to mention about the Temple Mount is that as it stands today, the way it looks today is largely the legacy of King Herod the Great, who lived in the first century BC. He rebuilt the Temple Mount on a massive scale, creating what was, in his day, the largest temple complex in the Roman Empire. In so doing, he cleared away so much of what was there from beforehand. In other words, he did what archaeologists hate, that is, get rid of evidence. What we've been able to excavate around the fringes, we've been able to piece together some things, but we haven't been able to dig right where we would like. And so, when we say that there is no evidence for David or Solomon ruling in Jerusalem, that's true. But we also have to realise that we have, to use a Donald Rumsfeld term, a known unknown in the Temple Mount. There's something there, surely, if only we could put a spade into it. So, what can we conclude from the discovery of the Tel Dan inscription? We can conclude that history intersects with the Bible at key points. It's plausible that David was a real person, that he was the founder of a new dynasty, that he was the founder of a new capital city, and he was the founder of the kingdom of Judah. The Tel Dan inscription also gives us some evidence for other events in the Bible also from roughly 200 years after David, such as the evidence of the skirmishes between Israel and Damascus. So the inscription gives us quite a lot of historical information. It gives us a number of points at which the Bible and history intersect. But we still must use caution. We still have to realise the evidence is scarce. And we mustn't make the mistake of thinking that one intersection between the Bible and history proves the whole lot. That would be a logical fallacy. That would be to turn a few buttons into an entire suit. It's just not right. We need a more measured approach to understanding how the Bible and history intersect, realising that it does intersect at key points, but this doesn't entail proving the lot. As much as I would like it to do so, we have to admit that it doesn't. So what do we mean when we say that the Bible is historical? First, we have to realise the difference between modern historiography and ancient historiography. When we do history today, we are conditioned by a whole lot of factors that people in the ancient world just simply didn't know about. We have libraries. We have many of them. We have libraries that we can join for free. We have access to millions upon millions of books all over the world. You don't have to travel very far to get your hands on a stack of books. Ancient people simply did not have this. They had the Library of Alexandria in late antiquity, but it's the exception that proved the rule. Once it was gone, then that's when we start talking about the Dark Ages. We have archives. We have realia. We have film archives. We have photographic archives. We have documentary archives. The ancients had tablets. They had very limited archives, and they were usually about very mundane things. They didn't have the kind of conservation and preservation mentality that we today have. They had very limited access to the archives that they did have. In the average city, if a city even had any archives, presumably they were available to just a handful of people. And archives were frequently destroyed. Such was the nature of living in the ancient world. Things got destroyed. We live after the age of the printing press and the mass distribution of books. The ancients had to hand copy everything, a painstakingly slow and expensive task. They had to copy with ink or carve into stone or clay, and literacy was extremely limited. The most generous estimates for literacy in the ancient world is 10% of the population, and that really is the very upper bracket. Most likely, literacy was hovering somewhere around 3 to 5% in the average society. We today live in an age of easy communication. We have satellites. We used to have telegraphs, but we could still send a message halfway around the world with a telegraph. We have newspapers, magazines, radios, TV, internet. We have information at our fingertips. The ancients had the odd runner, the odd courier who might take information from place to place, or the odd merchant who might drop a bit of information here and there at the various places that he visited. We also live with universities. We have had hundreds of years of universities where many people are able to get a high standard of education The ancients had no such thing. The ancients had a very limited education. It was only for a select few, and it was very limited in scope. Now, with such different contexts, the questions that we ask when we do history are very different to the kinds of questions that the ancients asked. And that's largely conditioned by the fact that we live in such different worlds. The task of history was shaped in the ancient world by very different variables. Historians today ask questions that are shaped by largely the Enlightenment of the 18th and 19th century. We largely ask two questions. What happened in the past? And why did it happen? That's largely how our law courts operate. We seek to determine what happened and then seek to find the motive. Why did it happen? It's a pursuit of the objective. It's an objective pursuit. But the ancients asked a very different question. They asked, what is the significance of the past to me? That's a very subjective question. Now, we need to understand the critical difference between those two approaches to history if we're to understand what we are actually affirming when we say that the Bible is history, as I think we should. But we need to understand that we are perhaps saying a little more than what we expected, or perhaps we are saying a little more than we are conditioned to expect. The Bible is history in artistic form. More specifically, it's history in a literary artistic form. Let me use an analogy. Michelangelo's David. Michelangelo was an artist. He had his own purpose in sculpting this particular piece of stone into the likeness that we know as his statue of David. He had his own purpose. He had his own style. He had his own creative instincts. He had his own context. Michelangelo is doing more than simply depicting David. He does not simply want to tell us David existed. He's actually doing more than that. He's exploring the human form. And he's saying how majestic the human form is by picking a famous biblical figure as his subject. And the result is a flawless piece of art that communicates so powerfully. When it comes to the Bible, we often overlook its artistic qualities. We often overlook the literary nature of the documents that are before us. And what that leaves us with is what I would call a transubstantiationary view of the text. Transubstantiation, I'm borrowing from Roman Catholicism. Transubstantiation is the doctrine that the bread and the wine in the Lord's Supper actually become the real physical body and blood of Jesus Christ. In other words, the bread and wine are changed into something else. I think quite often when we say the Bible is history, what we are actually saying is the Bible is itself the past. We are saying that the text somehow becomes interchangeable with the past. But that's a bit like treating Michelangelo's David as the actual man David who lived 3,000 years ago. But we have to realise that the Bible is not just plain history. It's not just seeking to give us history. That's part of its purpose, but it's not its sole purpose. The Bible is art. The Bible is literature. The Bible is not time. The Bible is not events of the past. That doesn't mean that the Bible is not historical. Please do not hear me say that. The Bible is historical. But the Bible represents history to us. And we have to understand the medium through which the Bible represents history to us. Time necessarily has to be repackaged into another form if we're going to retell it. This new form points to the original time, the original people, and the original events themselves, but the document that is produced is not itself the time, the people, and the events themselves. History has to be adapted into a different form. Time is adapted into words, into a text. It's the same kind of thing that we see film producers and screenwriters do with our modern films today, particularly when they are based on a true story. You might have seen one or both of these particular films, The King's Speech, based on the experiences of King George VI, and Mandela, Long Walk to Freedom. These are both about real people. They are both about real events. But reality has been adapted into a film. There can only be a single 16:9 ratio view. It has to be roughly 2-3 hours in length. That automatically implies selecting what goes in and selecting what goes out. History, which tends to just happen, has to be adapted into scenes. There has to be dialogue. And this dialogue has to enable the viewer to understand the characters. Trends occur over a long period of time. But trends have to be captured or condensed into miniature form, either with a particular scene or perhaps with a montage. One particular instance of this is in The King's Speech, where there is a roughly 30-second montage of King George VI interacting with his speech therapist, showing some various interactions between them, and you get a sense of a trend of these two men working together, making progress. Something that probably took months, and it's condensed into 30 seconds. And the film has to be interesting. Otherwise, it just won't communicate because no one will go and see it. The biblical documents are a lot like that. We tend to treat the biblical documents more like documentaries rather than feature films. But the David narrative, when we think about the person of David, the David narrative is actually not a documentary. It's not a report. It's not an historiographical treatise. It's a dramatic story. It has characters. It has a plot. It has twists, turns, predicaments. My students will know this particular term. It has denouement. It has dialogue. It has scenes. It has all the hallmarks of a literary masterpiece. History has been adapted into story form. There can only be words, not time. The length of the text is limited to a scroll's size. There are the scenes with primary, secondary, and tertiary characters. There is an omniscient narrator who speaks, sometimes telling you what a character is thinking. There is dialogue that, in Hebrew narrative, can only be between two people at a time. Very rarely does modern conversation occur between only two people at a time. And the David story in the Bible has a didactic purpose. It's not just trying to tell us, there was a David, and this is what he did. The David story in the Bible has a purpose of defending David's right to be the king of Israel and for his dynasty, the house of David, to be the rightful rulers of Israel rather than the house of Saul or any other dynasty for that matter. It has a didactic purpose. It is seeking to convince the reader that David is the man who has been favoured by God himself to be Israel's chosen king, that God has made a covenant with David, and that Israel's future, therefore, must have a Davidic king. That is so much more than simply telling us there was a David. Well, what can we conclude? We can conclude that the biblical documents need to be read as literature. They are art. The biblical documents, particularly relating to David, are history in artistic form. We need to understand that they have adapted the past and represented the past in a different form, literature. We need to understand their genre. In the case of the David narratives, this means understanding them as dramatic story. We need to understand their purpose. They are trying to do more than just convey history. They are trying also to persuade the reader of a particular perspective. And we also need to understand their theology. How do these documents reveal God? Events in and of themselves don't reveal God. Events in and of themselves mean nothing. Events have to be given meaning. And the biblical authors are assigning particular significance to the events of the past. Remember the question that the ancients asked. What is the significance of the past to me? Also, we mustn't try to make archaeology fit the biblical record. As tempting as that is, we must try and avoid it. It's natural to run to the Bible to see if archaeology intersects with it, and we should do that. We should always consult the Bible to see, are there actually intersections there with real history that we can corroborate outside of the Bible? But the Bible shouldn't set the agenda of archaeologists. In other words, it's actually right to expect archaeologists to leave the Bible behind and take just the spade with them on their excavations. That will enable them, as objectively as possible, to excavate and come to certain conclusions. And it's only after that that we can then look to see if there is any correspondence with the Bible itself. Excavating in Israel today is fraught with theological and political agendas. Every single find that is made in Israel is a political statement. Every single find. There is a lot riding on what they dig up in the ground in Israel. Both theologically, what it actually says about God, does it suggest anything about God? But also politically, what does this find say about whom this land belongs to? Recently, for example, Eli Shukron, who's pictured there, just last month, said that he had found the citadel that David had captured. You can see him walking around in what he describes as the fortress that David captured. That is big news in Israel. It is saying an Israelite, an ancestor of the Jews, ruled this particular territory. Other archaeologists look at Eli Shukron's finds and dispute them. Remember, in Jerusalem, we can't dig everywhere that we would like. We simply can't. And that means, inevitably, almost everything that is found in Jerusalem is ultimately ambiguous. There is always two sides to the story. Every claim, every find in Israel, in Jerusalem, is necessarily ambiguous. This is made even harder by the fact that excavations are often funded by largely political organisations. One particular organisation, the City of David Foundation, also known as Elad, sponsors all the excavations in this particular part of Jerusalem. You can imagine that they wouldn't want anything found that would go against their political agenda. They state objectivity, that they do not interfere with archaeologists' excavations. The archaeologists themselves affirm that that is the case. And yet, in such a highly charged territory and context, one can understand that natural bias would creep in. Credit goes to those archaeologists who really do aim for independent funding for their excavations and for objectivity in the reporting of their finds. Quite often, calling a press conference is an automatic trigger. We are going to get a sensational find here and a sensational understanding of the find. And when that's the case, you should always remember there must be another side to the story. As much as possible, we just need to let the stones speak. That's hard because stones themselves don't speak. Stones don't automatically suggest particular interpretations. We can think that archaeologists are simply digging things up and automatically interpretation suggests itself to them simply by the way they find things. It's not actually the case. As I mentioned, there are at least two ways to view everything that is found in the ground. Stones are mute and they have to be given interpretation and they have to be discussed in as objective a fashion as possible before we turn to the biblical text. Coming back to David. David has come back from the dead, as it were. And in so doing, he's shown us that there are a number of intersections between history and the Bible. And even though that is incredibly exciting for me, it is very exciting as someone who is very interested in archaeology and particularly in reading inscriptions. It's very exciting, but we have to keep level heads. We must continue reading the Bible as history in artistic form. When archaeology challenges the Bible, we shouldn't minimise it. Perhaps it's a means of helping us to understand the Bible's artistry. Perhaps we just need more information. Perhaps one day we'll find that information. Perhaps we will never get to it. But we shouldn't panic. And when archaeology does produce intersections with the Bible, then we can get excited. The Bible is historical. The Bible is history in artistic form, and archaeology has shown to us a number of intersections with the Bible as history. Thank you very much.